Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Only very occasionally do I sit across something and think to myself, there's something that's just missing in you. You simply have no chance of engaging properly with the rest of the world.
For the very first time, the greatest minds in criminology have come together to dissect the psyches of some of the world's most prolific serial killers. These forensic psychiatrists, psychologists, and pathologists have an incredible depth of knowledge and often first-hand insight into these killers, helping us to understand what makes a monster. The following is part two of an interview with Dr. Richard Badcock, recorded in August 2019 for Crime and Investigations TV series Making a Monster. Dr. Badcock currently teaches psychodynamics and psychology profiling at the University of Bradford. With a career that has incorporated some of the UK's most violent and dangerous offenders, Dr. Badcock has helped the police on many major investigations, including Harold Shipman and Robert Black. Warning, the subjects covered in this podcast are of a sensitive nature. Listener discretion advised.
I went up to Scotland to train in psychiatry, and that's the study of diseases of the brain, diseases of the mind. While I was there, I was lucky enough to have an attachment in forensic psychiatry and became very interested in that. Largely because it brought me into touch with the casual complexity of many people's lives. And it struck me that many of the offenders I was seeing were really wanting to achieve very normal things, very ordinary things, but nevertheless found themselves using quite sort of bizarre methods to achieve it. I wasn't particularly interested in rape and murder. It was really more the sort of thieves and the frauds and the drug addicts who seemed to find themselves going into really quite sort of bizarre routes to achieve what most of us would feel were perfectly ordinary things to want to have. I finished my forensic training in Scotland and got a consultant job in England, working in a regional secure unit, which was a network that was just starting up at that time. And while I was there, the police asked me to go and talk to them about psychiatry and offenders. So I did, and they asked me a lot of questions about profiling, which was a new topic then to me and something I knew nothing about. So as a result of that, I went up to a course in Dundee, which was being run by the FBI. And that turned out to be a course in which they really couldn't sort of give much of an explanation of how they did what they did. Their theoretical base was really quite weak. But what they did have was a seemingly endless collection of case studies illustrated by slides. which showed the full range of destructive behaviour, again, carried out by one person on another. And it soon passed the stage of sort of intellectual interest. In fact, it was quite sickening. In the time of feeling sickened, it struck me that this was something that really goes on to a much greater extent than we're normally exposed to, and that it was something that psychiatry should try and do something about, something which I should try and do something about. And so I became interested in trying to develop a method of clinical offender profiling. And that brought me back into contact with the police in various investigations. And then it brought me back into contact with offenders such as the ones that you're studying in this series. As a psychiatrist, I'm a doctor. You know, I stand in the Hippocratic tradition. That's where I get my ethics and my values from. And the basis of my knowledge is largely built up through studying cases. Psychologists have a very different training. You know, their training is in experimental techniques, in assessing information from studies, and in building up patterns of behaviour. So psychology tends to focus on behaviour. Psychiatry tends to focus on the mind. In the Hippocratic canon, written about 2,500 years ago, there are a number of points which translate very readily into the profiling environment. Because medicine was developed in Greece at a time when knowledge was limited, the risks were high of getting things wrong, people needed to be able to rely on the doctors to do the right thing by them. So the adaptation became, firstly, to extract the maximum amount of psychological information available from the offence and people who could give me information. The second was to analyse the information in accordance with the things which were most important for the investigation to know. In other words, they set the terms of reference, and then they would try and understand the case from that particular point of view. And then the third and vital thing was not to make exaggerated claims for the process and to resist arriving at any conclusions where the evidence could not be demonstrated for them. That bit's particularly important in psychological profiling because of the risk of bias. From time to time, I've been involved in cases, and that case has then been televised on Crime Watch or something like that. And in Crime Watch, they do a reconstruction. And the reconstruction really bears that close a resemblance to what actually happened because its purpose is to try and elicit more information from the public. Nevertheless, after many Crime Watch episodes, and certainly one or two I'm aware of, people have written in with extremely detailed analyses of who the offender must be on the basis of the Crime Watch presentation without any recognition at all that they might be wrong or that they might not have all the information or that, you know, any sense that they could be sincere but misguided. And that is such an important thing to bear in mind when you're trying to help an investigation.
Dr. Badcock's career has included working in numerous medium and high security prisons and interviewing suspects accused of committing serious offences, a process he found himself easily engaged with.
My experience is that offenders can't usually, in fact, they can only really very unusually tell me why they've done something. They're much more likely to be able to tell me what they've done. And one of the principles I use in profiling is that if I can find out in detail what happened and how it happened, then I can put those two things together to have an understanding of why things happened. And then I can compare that understanding with what the patient has told me. And then I can see where their particular difficulties might lie or where there might be need for further conversations. When you meet a doctor, normally, the consultation is completely confidential. In prison, because I'm seeing somebody for a report, it isn't. So I make a point of it being very clear at the outset that it's not a conversation that will be kept in confidence because I have to write the report, and that I want them to be as truthful with me as they feel they can. Very occasionally, there are things that they want to talk about, but they don't want to go into the report. So I routinely ask people to let me know if that's happening so that we can have a discussion about it before we proceed. On the whole, I find people quite willing to try to have an outside understanding of how they've got into the situation that they have. Because as I said earlier, what I found initially in this field of work was that ordinary people get into sort of complicated messes trying to achieve something which in itself is quite understandable and ordinary. But because they've got problems in their image of themselves, their relationships with other people, their circumstances in life, they find themselves going down different paths. Sometimes, often, almost without realising what they're doing. So people's awareness of the consequences of their actions is often quite limited at the outset. Truth in psychiatry is quite a sort of complicated thing. I'm interested in there being truthful in their account to themselves. The accounts are often not truthful in the sense that they're objectively accurate, but that's not a problem. I want to know how they think about what they've been charged with. And then if I can compare that with what they tell me about what they did and how it happened, I can arrive at my own assessment of why they did what they did. I can compare the two, and I can discuss it with them. The most important thing is to be straight with people. You know, if you're in prison, there's an expectation that you will be deceived or somehow worked against in some form. I find it safest to assume that I won't necessarily get the truth. That's not a problem. As long as the person, will give me their account of what they think happened, their account of why they think it happened, and their account of what they did, and I can get other information from the investigation about what the physical circumstances of the offence were, then I've got a lot of separate ways of looking at things which I can compare with each other and build up a picture. At the end of the day, I'm a doctor. My job is to help. So whether I'm interviewing somebody for on a charge of murder or a victim of rape or whatever, I always keep in mind that what I'm trying to do is accurately understand them, give that information back to them, and then if there's anything that they can use from that to help themselves understand why they got into that situation, so much the better. I'm not there to gather evidence against them. I'm there to build up a picture of how they got to the point that they have. I've rarely, if ever, come across a case where there is a simple, single explanation. As a doctor, I'm used to a scheme of looking at things which starts with birth and genetic predisposition, looks at early family circumstances, takes account of significant life events particularly in the formative period when personality is developing, takes account of their lifestyle at the time of the offence, looks at any particular singular events around the specific moments of offence, because often serial killings are precipitated by something. There's an immediate precipitant, so there's a series which has its own pathology, its own driving force, but the events only occur when there's a specific thing happening, usually a disturbance and an annoyance, or a sense that you've been ridiculed or upset in some way.
There are many theories about why humans commit unspeakable evil, but none of them are particularly comforting. If the childhood of serial killers are filled with abuse and hardship, then they can appear to be the victims of circumstance. But if murderers have charming upbringings and little to complain about, then could they be born evil?
I don't use evil, partly because it's not my prerogative to do it. You know, it's not my call to say what is evil, even though I know evil exists and I see it and I recognise it. But evil in the way it's used is mainly, I think, a term to try and sort of put a distance between the offender and you. And that seems to me to be understandable. But from my point of view of trying to understand and treat people who find themselves in that situation, it's a big mistake. Because what we need to examine is what we have in common and how it's changed in the lives of the people who've done these things. People who've scared me, they have mostly been ones in whom there's an active element of mental disorder, which makes them unpredictable. So paranoid psychotic patients who suddenly develop a fixed stare, you think, oh, shit. I mean, you know, I'm not a particularly abrasive psychiatrist, I think. I've been attacked 4 times in my career. Each time learning something really useful about human nature and what's involved. Only very occasionally do I sit across something and think to myself, there's something that's just missing in you. You simply have no chance of engaging properly with the rest of the world. That they're nearly all people who display arrogance. Not necessarily overtly. They're not necessarily openly aggressive. I mean, they will have been, you know, up to the point of going to prison or whatever. But they're not necessarily people who try to be intimidating at interview. They're usually much easier to deal with. But they're people who get a sense of a sort of chill reserve. And the chill reserve is an indication that, you know, that their capacity for will has been taken over by something that they've allied themselves to. So they've, and there's usually a sense of power. You know, so their be-all and end-all is power. But then I do remind myself that in the last analysis, evil is quite a trivial thing in relation to good. You know, that the dominant force in the world, however it appears on television, is good. Evil only exists in opposition to it, and is not itself a creative power at all.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
You know, the thinking about human nature is, well, it's part of the ongoing story of mankind, isn't it? You know, we've all been collectively thinking about human nature since the year dot. Each generation sort of builds up a different way of understanding it. You know, our need in this generation is to understand the patterns of things, including serial homicide, because it may not be a totally new phenomenon, but it is a bit of an explosion, isn't it? And it's one of the ironies of life that, you know, at a time when technologically we're making sort of huge advances, and everybody's got a smartphone and you don't need to do anything to get the information you want, that actually people are more dissatisfied than ever. And that the understanding of what constitutes healthy relationships is kind of being eroded away. I think partly because the emphasis now is on... economically, there's a lot of encouragement of envy, isn't there? You know, you're encouraged to envy individuals who are sort of picked out as being, you know, the current icons and what have you. And you're encouraged to be individual. And it's important to be an individual, to have an identity. But the focus of human life has always been not so much on individuality, but on belonging. And it's that sense of belonging and interrelatedness with other people which is at risk of being lost sight of, I think. And that somewhere in all that is part of the reason why serial killing has proliferated in the way it has, because the things that make you feel individual also run the risks of turning into things which make you so selfish that you then lose sight of what you're doing and you use other people as commodities and ends rather than their proper status. And once that happens, if you don't correct it, you are up the traditional creek without the helpful paddle.
In the next episode of Making a Monster, The Tapes, we have some fascinating interviews with forensic psychologists Dr. Eric Cullen and Dr. Adrian Needs, investigative psychologist and geographic profiler Dr. Sam Ludrigan, and forensic pathologist Dr. Richard Shepherd. And, of course, Crime and Investigations Making a Monster, the TV show, continues with a brand new episode every Monday, 9 p.m. Or you can download the full series to watch on demand. Let us know your thoughts. Tag your tweets with hashtag Making a Monster or leave a review on your preferred podcast app and we'll get back to you. You can also head to crimeandinvestigation.co.uk for more info on the series with profiles on all the killers featured. Making a Monster, the Tapes features interviews recorded by Monster Films for the Crime and Investigation TV series and was voiced by me, Cherry Healy, produced by Sam Pearson and Chloe Frost, with editing by Joel Porter.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.